Chapter 121. Am I to read it now? He asked. As I told him yes, he laid it on the table, and resting his head upon his hand, began. He had not read far, when he rested his head upon his two hands, to hide his face from me. In a little while he rose, as if the light were bad, and went to the window. He finished reading it there, with his back towards me, and after he had finished, and had folded it up, stood there for some minutes with the letter in his hand. When he came back to his chair, I saw tears in his eyes. Of course, Esther, you know what she says here? He spoke in a softened voice, and kissed the letter as he asked me. Yes, Richard. Offers me, he went on, tapping his foot upon the floor, the little inheritance she is certain of so soon just as little, and as much as I have wasted, and begs and prays me to take it, set myself right with it, and remain in the service. I know your welfare, to be the dearest wish of her heart, said one. And, oh, my dear Richard, Ada's is a noble heart. I am sure it is. I wish I was dead. He went back to the window, and laying his arm across it, leaned his head down on his arm. It greatly affected me to see him so, but I hoped he might become more yielding, and I remained silent. My experience was very limited. I was not at all prepared for his rousing himself out of this emotion to a new sense of injury. And this is the heart, that the same John Jarndyce, who is not otherwise, to be mentioned between us, stepped into estranged from me, said he indignantly. And the dear girl makes me this generous offer from under the same John Jarndyce's roof, and with the same John Jarndyce's gracious consent and connivance, I dare say, as a new means of buying me off. Richard! I cried out, rising hastily. I will not hear you say such shameful words. I was very angry with him indeed, for the first time in my life, but it only lasted a moment. When I saw his worn young face looking at me, as if he were sorry, I put my hand on his shoulder and said, If you please, my dear Richard, do not speak in such a tone to me. Consider. He blamed himself exceedingly, and told me in the most generous manner, that he had been very wrong, and that he begged my pardon a thousand times. At that I laughed, but trembled a little too, for I was rather fluttered after being so fiery. To accept this offer, my dear Esther, said he, sitting down beside me, and resuming our conversation, once more, pray forgive me. I am deeply grieved to accept my dearest cousin's offer is, I need not say, impossible. Besides, I have letters and papers that I could show you which would convince you it is all over here. I have done with the red coat, believe me. But it is some satisfaction, in the midst of my troubles and perplexities, to know that I am pressing Ada's interests in pressing my own. Voles has his shoulder to the wheel, and he cannot help urging it on as much for her as for me, thank God. His sanguine hopes were rising within him, and lighting up his features, but they made his face more sad to me than it had been before. No, no, cried Richard exultingly. If every farthing of Ada's little fortune were mine, no part of it should be spent in retaining me in what I am not fit for, can take no interest in, and am weary of. It should be devoted to what promises a better return, and should be used where she has a larger stake. Don't be uneasy for me. I shall now have only one thing on my mind, and Voles and I will work it. I shall not be without means. Free of my commission, I shall be able to compound with some small usurers who will hear of nothing but their bond now Voles says so. I should have a balance in my favor anyway, but that would swell it. Come, come. You shall carry a letter to Ada from me, Esther, and you must both of you be more hopeful of me, and not believe that I am quite cast away just yet, my dear. I will not repeat what I said to Richard. I know it was tiresome, and nobody is to suppose for a moment that it was at all wise. It only came from my heart. He heard it patiently and feelingly, but I saw that on the two subjects he had reserved it was at present hopeless to make any representation to him. I saw too, and had experienced in this very interview, the sense of my guardian's remark, that it was even more mischievous to use persuasion with him than to leave him as he was. Therefore I was driven at last to asking Richard, if he would mind convincing me, that it really was all over there, as he had said, and that it was not his mere impression. He showed me without hesitation a correspondence making it quite plain, that his retirement was arranged. I found, from what he told me, that Mr. Vholes had copies of these papers, and had been in consultation with him throughout. Beyond ascertaining this, and having been the bearer of Ada's letter, and being, as I was going to be, Richard's companion back to London, I had done no good by coming down. Admitting this to myself with a reluctant heart, I said I would return to the hotel, and wait until he joined me there, so he threw a cloak over his shoulders, and saw me to the gate, and Charlie and I went back along the beach. There was a concourse of people in one spot, surrounding some naval officers who were landing from a boat, and pressing about them with unusual interest. I said to Charlie this would be one of the great Indiaman's boats now, and we stopped to look. The gentlemen came slowly up from the waterside, speaking good-humoredly to each other, and to the people around and glancing about them, as if they were glad to be in England again. "Charlie, Charlie," said I, "come away." And I hurried on so swiftly that my little maid was surprised. It was not until we were shut up in our cabin room, and I had had time to take breath, that I began to think why I had made such haste. In one of the sunburnt faces I had recognized Mr. Alan Woodcourt, and I had been afraid of his recognizing me. I had been unwilling that he should see my altered looks. I had been taken by surprise, and my courage had quite failed me. But I knew this would not do, and I now said to myself, "My dear, there is no reason there is, and there can be no reason at all, why it should be worse for you now than it ever has been. What you were last month, you are today. You are no worse, you are no better. This is not your resolution. Call it up, Esther, call it up." I was in a great tremble with running, and at first, was quite unable to calm myself, but I got better, and I was very glad to know it. The party came to the hotel. I heard them speaking on the staircase. I was sure it was the same gentleman, because I knew their voices again. I mean I knew Mr. Woodcourt's. It would still have been a great relief to me to have gone away without making myself known, but I was determined not to do so. "No, my dear, no. No, no, no." I untied my bonnet and put my veil half up, I think I mean half down, but it matters very little, and wrote on one of my cards, that I happened to be there with Mr. Richard Carstone, and I sent it in to Mr. Woodcourt. He came immediately. I told him I was rejoiced to be by chance among the first, to welcome him home to England. And I saw, that he was very sorry for me. "You have been in shipwreck and peril since you left us, Mr. Woodcourt," said I, "but we can hardly call it a misfortune which enabled you to be so useful and so brave. We read of it with the truest interest. It first came to my knowledge through your old patient, poor Miss Flight, when I was recovering from my severe illness." "Ah, little Miss Flight," he said. "She lives the same life yet?" "Just the same." I was so comfortable with myself now as not to mind the veil, and to be able to put it aside. "Her gratitude to you, Mr. Woodcourt, is delightful. She is a most affectionate creature, as I have reason to say." You have found her so?" he returned. I am glad of that." He was so very sorry for me, that he could scarcely speak. "I assure you," said I, "that I was deeply touched by her sympathy and pleasure at the time I have referred to. I was grieved to hear that you had been very ill." "I was very ill." "But you have quite recovered?" "I have quite recovered my health and my cheerfulness," said one. "You know how good my guardian is, and what a happy life we lead, and I have everything to be thankful for, and nothing in the world to desire. I felt as if he had greater commiseration for me than I had ever had for myself. It inspired me with new fortitude and new calmness to find that it was I who was under the necessity of reassuring him. I spoke to him of his voyage out and home, and of his future plans, and of his probable return to India. He said that was very doubtful. He had not found himself more favored by fortune there than here. He had gone out a poor ship's surgeon, and had come home nothing better. While we were talking, and when I was glad to believe that I had alleviated, if I may use such a term, the shock he had had in seeing me, Richard came in. He had heard downstairs who was with me, and they met with cordial pleasure. I saw that after their first greetings were over, and when they spoke of Richard's career, Mr. Woodcourt had a perception that all was not going well with him. He frequently glanced at his face, as if there were something in it that gave him pain, and more than once he looked towards me, as though he sought to ascertain whether I knew what the truth was. Yet Richard was in one of his sanguine states and in good spirits, and was thoroughly pleased to see Mr. Woodcourt again, whom he had always liked. Richard proposed that we all should go to London together, but Mr. Woodcourt, having to remain by his ship a little longer, could not join us. He dined with us, however, at an early hour, and became so much more like what he used to be that I was still more at peace, to think I had been able to soften his regrets. Yet his mind was not relieved of Richard. When the coach was almost ready, and Richard ran down to look after his luggage, he spoke to me about him. I was not sure that I had a right to lay his whole story open, but I referred in a few words to his estrangement from Mr. Jarndyce, and to his being entangled in the ill-fated Chancery suit. Mr. Woodcourt listened with interest, and expressed his regret. "I saw you observe him rather closely," said I. "Do you think him so changed?" "He is changed," he returned, shaking his head. I felt the blood rush into my face for the first time, but it was only an instantaneous emotion. I turned my head aside, and it was gone. "It is not," said Mr. Woodcourt, "his being so much younger or older, or thinner or fatter, or paler or ruddier, as there being upon his face such a singular expression. I never saw so remarkable a look in a young person. One cannot say that it is all anxiety or all weariness, yet it is both, and like ungrown despair." "You do not think he is ill?" said one. "No. He looked robust in body. That he cannot be at peace in mind, we have too much reason to know," I proceeded. "Mr. Woodcourt, you are going to London?" "Tomorrow or the next day." "There is nothing Richard wants so much as a friend. He always liked you. Pray see him when you get there. Pray help him sometimes with your companionship if you can. You do not know of what service it might be. You cannot think how Ada, and Mr. Jarndyce, and even I, how we should all thank you, Mr. Woodcourt." "Miss Summerson," he said, more moved than he had been from the first, "before heaven, I will be a true friend to him. I will accept him as a trust, and it shall be a sacred one." "God bless you," said I, with my eyes filling fast, but I thought they might, when it was not for myself. "Ada loves him, we all love him, but Ada loves him as we cannot. I will tell her what you say. Thank you, and God bless you, in her name." Richard came back as we finished exchanging these hurried words, and gave me his arm, to take me to the coach. "Woodcourt," he said, unconscious with what application, "pray let us meet in London." "Meet?" returned the other. "I have scarcely a friend there now but you. Where shall I find you?" "Why, I must get a lodging of some sort," said Richard, pondering. "Say at Vole's, Simmons Inn." "Good." Without loss of time. They shook hands heartily. When I was seated in the coach, and Richard was yet standing in the street, Mr. Woodcourt laid his friendly hand on Richard's shoulder and looked at me. I understood him, and waved mine in thanks. And in his last look as we drove away, I saw that he was very sorry for me. I was glad to see it. I felt for my old self as the dead may feel, if they ever revisit these scenes. I was glad to be tenderly remembered, to be gently pitied, not to be quite forgotten. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.